The story is told that during the Paris riots of 1848, an army officer received orders to evacuate a certain square by firing upon the rabble. He left the garrison with his troops and started for the square to be cleared. Upon his arrival, he took up a position with his soldiers, who raised their rifles to fire upon the crowd. In the profound silence that followed, he cried out, "I have received the order to fire upon the rabble, but as I perceive before me many honest people, I ask them to depart so that I may execute the order." In a few moments, the square was vacant. I think this is a wonderful story, and a very encouraging one at a time when rivals increasingly settle into invincible positions. And sometimes I despair of how we can ever get beyond this dangerous impasse. Conspiracy theorists occupy crazy positions, sacrificing every last shred of objective truth and common decency to maintain a grievance-fueled rage against their hated rivals. Some will die rather than give an inch to their opponents, like Ashley Babbitt, who was shot dead by a policeman during the US Capitol siege. She was an angry QAnon devotee who'd been tweeting that Joe Biden is a paedophile. Then there's Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. Where do we start? She believes that lasers were mounted on orbital satellites by Jewish bankers like George Soros, and that these lasers caused the last round of California wildfires. She also believes that a couple of school massacres, including Sandy Hook, were covert acts by Democrats aimed at undermining support for gun rights. Or you may remember One Nation Senator Malcolm Roberts arguing on Q&A against scientific evidence for climate change, up against an increasingly exasperated Professor Brian Cox. Now, you can't seem to win with these people. Indeed, rabid ideologues sometimes just have to be put down by force, as was the case with Nazism in World War II, one of the great conspiracy theories of all time. Though some supporters of conspiracy theories can be won over and convinced to stand down. Very occasionally, even one of the chief protagonists of these insane views will be persuaded to change their tune. My story of a French officer shows that self-defining rivalries and entrenched positions aren't invincible. That de-escalation, even change of heart, is possible. The tit-for-tat rivalries that possess people can be exorcised. These demonic powers still yield to the critical, psychological, and spiritual power that emerges most clearly in our Lord Jesus Christ. And as far as I'm concerned, this represents the greatest miracle of all. The French officer story is explored by a practitioner of conflict resolution called Pierre Delbay. Here's how he explains what's going on. The officer knows that these people before him are not rabble, and the crowd knows that he knows. The crowd does not for all that renounce its basic opposition, and the officer respects that decision by not making any allusion to it. His declaration is in no way an argument, but rather an invitation to avoid confrontation by mutual respect. While taking the crowd seriously, the officer mocks his superiors with the crowd by asking indirectly of the rogues to not budge while the honest people leave the square. This good-natured pleasantry is charged with benevolence. The crowd is touched, It understands the invitation of the officer and consents to it, for it has permitted them to leave with their heads held high. They accept being saved and defer their struggle. Now, friends, it seems to me that this whole dilemma and this potential solution to it is what we see playing out in today's readings. The Epiphany of Jesus Christ continues to reveal new aspects in this season. And today we see his power and wisdom at work in miracles of reconciliation, banishing the demons of rivalry, the madness of mutually assured destruction. Let's start with St. Paul in our epistle today, who we see caught up in a major church conflict. Now, Paul is standing on his dig, not yielding his authority in the Corinthian church. But he does this in a way that prevents rivalry from escalating and taking hold. He makes a case for church leaders like him to be able to make a living at it, something our parish priests still typically do to this day. But then Paul refuses to insist on it, since no doubt such payments had obviously become a bone of contention. Paul doesn't claim his rights to avoid fueling rivalry with his opponents. Then he goes on with that strange speech about being all things to all people. Paul is refusing to set himself up in self-defining opposition to others in the church. To the Jews under the law, he's one of them. Yet he's not separating himself from the Gentile Christians who don't follow the Jewish law. Likewise, he sides with the weak, such as those we heard about last week, for instance, whose consciences troubled them about the widespread practice of eating meat that you could buy after it had been offered to an idol in the temple. Paul insists on being all things to all people so that his mission as an agent of their salvation will not be hindered. Now, this doesn't mean that he makes himself a doormat or a pushover. You could never accuse Paul of that. He's simply faithful to the gospel, and he has his own personal neediness well under control. Now, I must confess to times when I personally have failed in this challenge. When I was a parish priest, earlier when I was a theological college principal. And what happened on a couple of occasions was that I ended up in rivalry with people over whose emotional needs would be met, mine or theirs. It's the same siege mentality that can engulf a family whenever immature teenagers and scarcely more mature parents end up locked in mutual antagonism, each nursing their hurts and their unexamined, unaddressed neediness. But not so for St. Paul, and no longer for me anymore either, once I'd woken up to this spiritual and theological lesson back in my mid-40s. But let me be very clear. I'm not offering secular good advice here, as if these miracles of human transformation, healing families and churches and nations and locked up individuals, as if these can easily happen if we just master the right techniques. We're dealing with the most intractable manifestations of sin here, the addiction to self-justification, possessed by a dysfunctional craving to blow up the other rather than examine ourselves, the tendency to demonize and monsterize the other while failing to see how readily we become just like them. Because the deeper we sink into rivalry, the more indistinguishable we become from our rival, the more we become possessed by our rival, and in turn, them by us. God has the power to overcome this all too familiar, this everyday form of demonic possession and return his people from exile. In the culture wars, for instance, and from every other hellhole of bitter alienation. Isaiah, in our Old Testament reading today, is telling through this set of passages of such a return from exile along a purpose-built high road back to the holy city. And what we find there is germinal to what I'm saying. Today's Isaiah passage is distinctive in the Old Testament because it brings together God's covenant and God's creation, with the wonders of creation invoked as a pointer to the wonderful things our God is capable of doing. So creation in the Old Testament shouldn't be read as pre-scientific fantasy, but as testimony to the power of our God to make things come right, which is meant here to embolden and to strengthen a weakened Israel. And you see today's psalm picking up the same theme. The wonder of stars and weather and animal life join in testimony to the saving capacity of Israel's God. So we're not stuck with a chronically divided world, and neither are we stuck with having to fix it entirely through our own strength and wisdom, because our God is on the case. And so I come to today's gospel. The demons are silenced and driven out as Jesus' emancipation of human beings begins. I'm reading demonic possession here along the lines I've been setting out. People possessed by rivalry, obsessed, driven literally out of their minds in their grievances, destructive of themselves and of others. And there's no easy remedy for this dire situation. But Jesus making present God's liberating love and righteousness, Jesus giving us an identity in baptism so that we don't have to forge our own identity at somebody else's expense in lives of rivalry and exclusion, Jesus is able to overcome this evil. And so, of course, the demons are silenced, because rivalry declines whenever it's starved of oxygen. When all the stupid talk and accusations cease, this escalating rivalrous dynamic is nipped in the bud. Now, I note in particular, and I've pointed this out to you in other gospel passages before, I note in particular that Jesus is wary of the crowd in today's gospel, the way it urgently presses on him, and the way his disciples come and say, "Everyone's looking for you, everyone's looking for you," trying to ramp up the whole thing, caught up in it. Now, crowds have a mind of their own, which very quickly possesses the minds of crowd members. Crowds are easily whipped up, manipulated, and led where many crowd members might otherwise be unwilling to go. All this we saw most recently in the US Capitol insurrection, as the Senate prosecution brief against Donald Trump for this week's impeachment trial puts it, and I quote, "He summoned a mob to Washington, exhorted them into a frenzy, and aimed them like a loaded cannon down Pennsylvania Avenue." It's significant then that Jesus gets up before the crowd and gets well out of their way and goes off on his own to a quiet place to pray, to escape the contagion of populism. And when his mission begins, it's low key, it's person by person, as with Peter's mother-in-law in today's gospel, and then synagogue by synagogue, village by village. There's no social media storm, no million-man march. So friends, there is a way beyond the crisis in which we find ourselves in today's political world with the culture wars, also on a more familiar level in churches like Paul's church at Corinth, and in families. Jesus, the great emancipator, frees human beings from their possession by rigid rivalries, their exile in irretrievable situations, He embodies this saving mission from Isaiah's God, whose power in creation is also a power for liberation, as we see in Isaiah's testimony today about the return of God's people from exile. Now, our Eucharist enacts this emancipation, making it our weekly springboard into a different way of living. Our vocation of Christians going out from the Eucharist is to be agents of this remarkable possibility. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.